the Development Policy Centre podcast. In this episode, we bring you an event on leveraging the benefits of Asia's integration and growth for Pacific economies, which was based on the findings in a recent Asian Development Bank book of the same title. Presentation slides are available on our website, devpolicy.anu.edu.au.
Right, so good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Crawford School, for those of you that have come from outside the university. My name is Matthew Donner. I'm a research fellow at the Development Policy Centre. Let me begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, the Ngunnawal people, and by paying respects to their elders past and present. So today we're fortunate to have two visitors from the Asian Development Bank and from the Asian Development Bank Institute, the think tank for the ADB. Out of Tokyo. They'll be presenting this book, which was published last week, Pacific Opportunities, Leveraging Asia's Growth. Of course, we hear a lot at the Crawford School about growth in Asia. Growth in the Pacific, of course, not so impressive, and where it has been impressive, there's a good case that it has not been inclusive or led to better development outcomes. So I think that our speakers will speak for around 15 minutes each. Christopher Edmonds will kick off. Just briefly, Christopher Edmonds is a senior economist in the Pacific Department of the ADB. He manages the department's economic research and is the editor-in-chief of the Pacific Economic Monitor. He's also responsible for managing ADB's work on a number of technical assistance projects in the Pacific region. And in fact, one of the things that Christopher has been very involved in recent months is the organisation of the Pacific Update, which was held with the Development Policy Centre this year in Suva. So we moved it away from Canberra and towards Suva, although we will have a panel with speakers from the update as part of SSGM's State of the Pacific Conference in early September. And Matthias Helble is with the Asian Development Bank Institute. His research interests include international trade, health, environment, and urban economics. He's worked on a number of flagship reports, such as the World Trade Report, and has published in a number of books and scientific journals, including in the Review of World Economics, Journal of the World Trade, World Economy, Health and Place, and the Bulletin of the World Health Organization. So I might hand over to Christopher.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you all very much for coming and giving us a chance to overview what I think it's an over 200, 300-page book. And it's the result of work that's been ongoing at ADB for a number of years. That said, it's also just basically the first foray into an area of research that we hope to work on much more over the next few years, at least. So what I'm here to do is to try to give you a flavor of the book, an overview of some of the main messages, which, frankly, for this audience that's familiar with the Pacific, I think they're fairly understandable and nothing too shocking in there. It's really some of the details. And I'll try to highlight what I see as being some of the contributions of this book. And then my colleague Matthias will take over and talk. Stephen Howes, when we discussed this presentation last week at the Pacific Update Conference, was saying, actually, it would be good to get some of the more analytical work. So Matthias will talk about two of the particular analytical pieces that went into this work. So in terms of the outline, actually, I've changed this, so I'll just walk you through the outline of the book. I'll save key messages for the end. The big idea is to highlight some of the opportunities the Pacific stands to benefit from in terms of developments in Asia. And then look at, you know, in terms of enabling the Pacific to take advantage of those new opportunities, what is ADB identifying as being sort of the key measures, policy measures or investments that they need to do. Then, obviously, in thinking about the future, we want to look at, well, what's happened in recent years over the last decade or so in terms of the linkages between Asia and the Pacific, or the Pacific with the rest of the world in general, and finally get to the conclusions where I will address the key messages of the study. So the book starts by looking at the current economic conditions in Asia and the Pacific, particularly borrowing from an extensive study that ADB headed sort of like a Pacific futures thing, and see where do we see Asia being by the year 2030, given recent trends, and bringing some hardcore modeling of that. And then we'll look at the links between Asia and the Pacific, in particular the trade links on both the import and export side, and then three key links in terms of foreign currency flows into the Pacific, the FDI, labor migration and remittances, and then ODA, and then talk about the priorities for strengthening links and the different ways to do that. Okay. So opportunities for growth. I mean, obviously, I think everyone knows, you know, over the last 10 years, we've seen this explosion in global trade where there's been an eightfold increase in total trade between Pacific and Asia, with an estimate of going from the total value of imports and exports going from 1.2 million billion to 14.5 billion. We note that, you know, most of this is mostly meeting rising demand for primary commodities from the Pacific, although we do see a number of niche market linkages developing, and we've also seen a massive rise in the importance of fisheries revenues through fishing license fees. So these are the things that are happening on the trade side. We have important demographic changes taking place in the Asia region that we think will create opportunities for the Pacific in terms of rising population, but particularly rise in the size of the global middle class and all the consumption demands that a rising middle class would bring. And in this is most important in this phenomenon is obviously the rise of the middle class in China, where you have a large proportion of the population going from rural existence in subsistence agriculture in China, moving towards an increasingly urbanized population that will demand a lot more goods. So in moving people from subsistence to a more urban lifestyle, obviously their consumption demands increase. And this should increase things. So you can see, according to the projection, we'll have roughly 5 million people in the middle class projected by 2013, and this very rapid rise where you know, the latest estimate about 10% net doubling by 2030 to 22% of the global middle class. Obviously, where you draw the line for the middle class depends a lot where your numbers come out. This probably used a fairly low threshold for the definition of middle class, but still the point is, you know, if you have large proportions of the population moving to an area where they're more engaged in the commercial economy, demanding more goods, becoming global consumers, that should create a large increase in global demand. And you can see some of the definition that was used. So over half of the world's middle class will be in Asia. So this figure should probably be 5.0 rather from a different source. And we particularly see opportunities in two key things. High-value niche agricultural crops from the Pacific seem like a clear advantage where consumers based in China and elsewhere in Asia will increasingly demand these products, especially when you look at an Asia that's being viewed as somewhat environmentally undesirable. So as a source for agricultural products, you know, we probably all heard about the concerns about the quality of the agricultural crops coming out of China. And we could see that a lot of that production being now all of a sudden, even though traditionally the Pacific's had high transport costs, all of a sudden it becomes a very attractive location for some of this stuff. And we already see this happening. And obviously tourism. Tourism is a luxury good, but again, with rising middle class population, the opportunities for tourism demand. And, you know, that's a vastly expanding market. The Pacific has been reaping a smaller proportion than the rest of the world in terms of the rise to date. But we actually see that market becoming very diversified and creating all sorts of opportunities sufficient to overcome the relatively high cost of the Pacific, because it'll offer a unique destination. And then the whole issue of that probably most of you are familiar with, population aging. I mean, one outcome of the one-child policy in China is you have a very skewed demographic profile, so they're going to have a real problem with the dependency ratio in China. And we see this is probably a little further off than some of the other things, but potential opportunities for the Pacific in the area of retirement destinations or at least senior travel. Obviously, you know, the Pacific needs to do a lot to improve their health and, you know, law and order in some of the countries, but there are opportunities there. Or it'll create opportunities for overseas work for Pacific workers trained in health fields, for example, which some of the governments are already pursuing. So other trends in Asia that we've seen is, you know, the past decade or so, we've seen evolving nature of public-private partnerships in Asia and SOE reforms. So that's something that's happened in Asia. It helps account for some of the growth we're seeing in Asia. And it's definitely something that is a very active area of reform needs in the Pacific. So the book discusses some of the lessons about how do you execute these things. All of these changes are challenging, but actually the Pacific can, even though the environments are very distinct, the Pacific can actually benefit from some of the experience and how do you sort through the different stakeholder issues to achieve SOE reform. Maturing financial regulation and financial sector. So we see banks in China now becoming much more active in global finance, maybe increasing competition in the Pacific region. Again, how do you invigorate your financial sector? Again, lessons from Asia. Obviously, advances in internet technology, global connectedness are something that we see having very significant implications in terms of enabling the Pacific to take part in the global economy, the growth in Asia. And ADB has a very active portfolio of undersea cable, fiber optic cable projects. That's sort of seen as being a really important investment to enable the Pacific to overcome its distance advantage, its small scale advantage, by being connected in the cyber universe, as it were. And finally, small and medium enterprise finance and lessons for the Pacific. This idea of hometown investment trusts, coming up with mechanisms to collect national savings and get them invested locally is something that has made great progress in Asia. And again, we see it being useful in the Pacific. So priorities for improving links based on the Asian experience is lowering trade costs. Again, that should be familiar to everyone here in terms of, we all know that, you know, it is a fairly remote, the Pacific remains a remote and relatively high-cost destination for trade, for visiting, for tourism. So obviously that's been a core of ADB's work program in the Pacific region for years, is improving that transport infrastructure. The ICT is a particularly emerging issue I mentioned earlier, but also the need to improve soft infrastructure. So even if you have the best port, if you have a terrible arrangement in terms of the stevedores, that'll be the binding constraint. So you need to make improvements in the soft infrastructure. And there's actually lessons in terms of ASEAN integration, the way they've made the single window, for example, to improve the trade links between the ASEAN countries was a very important thing. And that's something that the Pacific really needs to think about, a hub and spokes model for trade, where, you know, basically goods are centrally cleared through either PNG or Fiji, perhaps, and then branched out to rationalize that. So we're thinking about that. Aviation liberalization is another very important area for the Pacific development, particularly as it relates to taking advantage of the rising demand for tourism globally and getting a market share of that rising demand to the Pacific region. And a lot of these things in terms of fostering regional connectivity, rationalizing the Pacific, rather than having trying to have a major international airport in every capital of the Pacific, think about the hub and spokes. We already have that with Fiji, and this is where the rapprochement between Australia and Fiji is actually really promising, because Fiji was the traditional hub, but re-strengthening that. So now we have Fiji Airways increasingly extending its routes, becoming the regional carrier. You also have Air New Guinea also stepping up, so these are very encouraging developments. And, you know, the idea in the long run, maybe even the production networks in Asia could spill over to the Pacific. We've been hearing for years about call centers in Fiji as a possibility. We have some garments, but not really too much. We have a wire harness factory as part of the automobile supply chain in Samoa that had a very heavy private sector role. But there may be some areas where you could see with the other changes, all of a sudden maybe the Pacific, especially the larger Pacific countries, taking advantage of it. I guess Fiji in particular. Okay, other lessons from Asia, obviously, is raising agricultural productivity is one thing. I think that's because, you know, the Pacific is largely import-dependent. That's probably less important in the Pacific than it was in Asia. In Asia, it was very instrumental. But the tourism, expanding visitor markets, and improving connectivity, strengthening education and skills development. You could see where that was an important component to being able to take advantage of some of the other opportunities. And obviously maintaining just a stable environment, ensuring stakeholder involvement. And Matthias will speak at length sort of about the exchange rate policy to foster stability and facilitate trade and investment. Okay. So how am I on time? I'm doing okay, I guess. 5 more minutes or so. I'll quickly review some of the major trends. Just in terms of the explosion of exports. So again, we mentioned this earlier. What's interesting to me, a little surprising, so we've seen this, you know, huge increase in Asian trade, but actually the Asian export, the share of Pacific exports going to Asia has actually fallen. So this is almost 50%, and down here it's closer to 40%. So it's actually fallen. So they're actually the Pacific is finding better markets in Europe, United States, and Australia, New Zealand. But huge explosion, you know, by all accounts that should continue. Import side, we have a slightly different picture with Asia really pushing out some of the more traditional partners on the import side. So that's an even a 15-fold increase, 16-fold increase on the value of Asian imports to the Pacific region. And that's typical with global trends. Just quickly, you know, I think most of you would be familiar with the basic the goods that Pacific is trading in large volume across the country. So this table's in the report as well. And you can just see who the main partner economies are. Again, where PRC is mostly seen as the economy that's demanding the raw materials, the timber, the energy products, whereas some of the other more niche products are going to the more developed economies. Okay. Just rounding out the 14 countries of the ADB member countries in the Pacific. So turning to recent tourism trends, we've had this, you know, very, very strong growth in the tourism. I'm dividing the economies of the Pacific, the 14 economies, into 3 groups. I really think of this as you have the microstates, you know, they have their own unique problems and probably never going to see very large tourism. Then you have the resource export-led economies, PNG, Solomon Islands, Timor-Leste. And actually, the growth has been strongest there, but this is where it's very important to see that it's visitor arrivals, not tourist arrivals. So most of these people, presumably, these are very small-scale industries, and most of it is probably people, either development professionals or people associated with the resource extraction industries, very few tourists as such. The other groups, the people that aren't microstates and aren't export-led growth economies, are really the staple of what we think of as the South Pacific, well, the Pacific economies. And these all tend to have fairly sizable tourism sectors. And you can see the growth is very, you know, relatively strong across these economies, although not keeping up with, if you compared the growth rates to the overall growth rate in international departures, the Pacific is falling relatively behind in this. And you can see only Fiji is, so I actually have 2 axes on here, and you can actually see Fiji, that bright green line, you know, some ups and downs, but a general strong growth trend. The other one, that the comparator would be Maldives, where you have a little stronger growth. So the other countries are using the x-axis on the left-hand side, but so much more lower levels of tourism. To me, looking at the global market and the size of these countries, actually, all of the tourism is way below potential. I mean, if you just think about, you know, the number of visitors to Hawaii or to some of these other economies, there's so much growth potential in the Pacific if they really want to go for it. I mean, that becomes the question is, you know, how much do you want to change? Because the rising tourism arrivals have a cost. And so that's the thing to think about. But, you know, huge potential there. And you can see already, you know, the tourism sector is of vital importance to some of the economies with Palau, Cook Islands, Vanuatu, and so forth, where it's basically seen as being the sector that will really, if we're going to have rising incomes in the Pacific, it's probably going to be tourism that's driving that. I mean, Palau right now over the past few years has been going through an incredible boom as packaged tourists from the People's Republic of China are visiting in massive numbers under the approved destination status agreement. And it's actually raising, you know, sustainability concerns in terms of what's the holding, you know, what's the load that the fragile coral sites in Palau, can they handle that? You're getting problems of congestion in tourism. So we're trying to work with them to figure out things. They've really struggled with it. And I think it's actually a precursor to what a number of the economies are facing. I think if any of you have been to Fiji recently, also you see this massive influx of Chinese visitors. And it disrupts the market to some extent. It's a good thing. We always want growth. We want more tourism. But it really does require the government to sort of increase its role to step up. And I'll come back to that point later. But you can see tourism is here. Tourism is likely to grow. It's the opportunity sector. The FDI picture is a little more muddied. We do see a rise in the volume, the share of GDP, much less, but that has more to do with the ODA flows. And the other thing you'll see in this is because these are aggregated at a regional level, it's really the PNG effect. Whenever you look at anything across these 14 countries, it's PNG. So here you see the LNG pipeline boom, basically. But again, we hope that as these countries stabilize their foreign investment environments, improve their business environments, they should be getting more capital. They're relatively capital scarce countries. So if they could guarantee and create an environment in which returns on capital were fine, we think that they could do that. But that's been an extreme struggle. And then labor and remittance ties. You see that's grown. Even despite the global financial and economic crisis, they had a couple down years, but it's recovered since then. It's obviously a typo, I think. Let's see. And you can see the countries that are the largest are receiving the largest remittances. And that's going to continue to be a tie. And I know Development Policy Center spends a lot of time, you know, one of their main areas of focus is the labor migration and remittances, particularly with respect to the agricultural worker programs with New Zealand and Australia. And that's going to be very, very important. But from our perspective, in addition to just the money that it's bringing in, there's all those other benefits that are coming. And when I come back to lessons, I think building upon those people-to-people linkages. So it's also the money they're bringing, the skills they're bringing, the idea of the Pacific diaspora. Those are going to be real opportunities that the Pacific can leverage on when it thinks about taking advantage. So it's the Pacific diaspora in Australia, United States, Asia, and also the Asian diaspora in the Pacific. Those can be the conduits for improving trade, investment, and those things. I think if we go to looking at things at a case study level, we'll see that it's very important. And then finally, you have, of course, the biggest player in the room driving economic fluctuations is overseas development assistance. We see that, you know, despite the global financial and economic crisis, not a big drop-off, increasing competition between different development partners and multilateral and bilateral development partners in the area. This doesn't include China figures because this is using the OECD data. So, in fact, it's probably larger. Okay, I'm running out of time. Thanks. If you put those three things together, it's kind of interesting to look at it. And again, I can't cover all the book. Please read the book. But you can actually see, I don't think it's so useful to look at the overall Pacific because of the PNG effect. It's just mirroring it. But it's interesting to see, you see that the volatility of things in the relatively diversified economies, we see that. But we also see that these are the countries that have the most vibrant private sectors, maybe because of their tourism, but also because of their niche agriculture. But you can see that's actually, proportionally, the FDI is most important. So that's why we call them relatively diversified. That's the whole reason, if you look at these charts. Smallest island economies, it's not that they don't have remittances. They're not reporting their remittances. But you can see the microstates, you know, these are essentially ODA-dependent economies and will be for the foreseeable future. I was a little surprised by how even PNG, Timor-Leste, and Solomon Islands were still, ODA was so much more dominant. Again, admittedly, each of these have serious measurement issues. When we look at these things, we know ODA doesn't capture it all, but probably it's the one that's easiest to capture. Remittances, we know that we're not capturing a lot of it. A lot of it is coming in cash in suitcases or all these new channels of remitting. And FDI, what a difficult thing to capture. To capture the amount of flows there, but you can see just how huge the overseas development assistance is in terms of driving economic growth in these economies. Okay. So the conclusions, I'll be very quick here. We do see massive opportunities, massive upside. So I mean, it's actually an optimistic vision for the Pacific. But two things that probably no one here needs to be reminded of is, and something we constantly work with the countries to clarify, is that the private sector is the main conduit for those links, and the government's role is to facilitate but avoid creating or directing those links overly. So if you work in the region, you see a number of cases where countries feel like they have a lot of money in their pockets right now and are venturing into things like hotel investments, and we really try to fight that. Stick to the infrastructure, stick to the rule of law. These are the things that are the appropriate government roles. You have enough to do there. Don't be messing in sectors that are properly kept to the private sector.
Okay.
Reducing, so things to reduce the relatively high trade costs. So that's the investments, both soft and hard infrastructure development. And then looking for regional approaches to rationalize. So overcoming the high fixed cost of developing transport infrastructure across the countries. And there's a range of government areas of government service where we do see opportunities for regional cooperation to lower costs. And we see a number of recent achievements in this. Thinking just like the parties to the Nauru Agreement is an area where, through cooperating, the countries have come up with a rational vessel day scheme, and as a result, been able to really negotiate much more effectively with the fishing industries in Asia, the United States, and Australia to get much more share of the returns from the fisheries.
Okay.
And then, as I mentioned before, that we really see the people as being the conduit through which we strengthen the existing networks, and you see them in a number of areas where. Taking advantage of the diaspora, taking advantage of the migration can really, really strengthen those linkages. And lastly, just to highlight the need for proactive government policy to ease the transition. So with this rise, I mean, the rise of, you know, increasing linkage with Asia is going to come at considerable cost, both social, cultural, and governments really need to think about that. There are winners and losers in this thing when you have this kind of transition. So, for example, in the case of Palau right now, the traditional tourism operators, especially the dive companies, are really seeing a negative downside from the rise of the package tourists because they don't spend as much and they don't tend to go diving. So now the more well-heeled tourists from Europe and the United States that used to be the staple in Japan, that used to be the main tourist visit, they can't get hotel rooms. So they're actually getting crowded out by a lower-value tourist from China. So the government is really struggling with how do you come up with those mechanisms. We know there's going to be extreme financial costs, and if the government doesn't address them proactively, you are going to have riots in the Chinatowns and things like that. So that's something that really needs to think about. Recognizing that the transitional costs will be large and coming up with compensation mechanisms. And finally, understanding the most important thing is to connect the fragility of the exact things that give the Pacific comparative advantage in the global economy, they're fragile, and the countries really need to be focused on preserving them. Thanks very much. Sorry to go over time. Matthias will talk even quicker.
So my name is Matthias Held. I'm a research fellow at ADBI. ADBI is in Tokyo. We're about 50 people working on different research projects. So I just want to quickly walk you through two papers that are a spin-off of this book, and since we have here more an academic conference, I thought it's good to show you some of our results, and I hope that we can have a discussion afterwards, so I will keep it really, really short. One paper is about the transport connectivity, so it's more a trade paper. The other one is a macro paper, so I cover a large field here, but I try to do my best within 10-15 minutes to show you some results. When I started to work on the Pacific, of course, as a trade economist by education, I thought it's very important to have a better knowledge about the connectivity of the Pacific Islands. So I tried to look up some data on the connectivity, but I couldn't find much. So, but then finally I found a new database that hasn't been explored much yet. Actually, all ships that travel overseas, they emit signals to say we're in a certain location and actually to avoid collision. And this data is collected every 3 minutes, so all ships know where the other ship is. And so this data has not been used yet in research much. So I thought this data could be useful to trace the connectivity of the Pacific. And it's collected by several companies that offer them access, but it's not publicly available information. You have to pay for access. And then I matched this data with trade data and looked at the importance of connectivity. The main research tool for all of us as trade economists is the gravity equation. So I ran several gravity equations on this data set. May I ask how many of you are economists and trade economists in the room? Economists, okay, not so many. Okay, then I don't go into a lot of details. I will just show you some more graphs, the big brush. Yeah. So the trade data, whenever you look for trade data, you normally go to UN Comtrade. It's an organization based in Geneva. It's collected in New York, based on national data. So we had this trade data. Then we were able to access this shipping data, which is the first time that this shipping data is collected for the Pacific. And so we were able to look at the number of ships for 1 year that traveled within the Pacific and also ships that traveled from the Pacific to Asia. And the same we did then also for the flight connection. So the thicker the line, the more flight connections they are. And so if you look at how the Pacific is connected to Australia and Asia, we see that Australia plays really a very important role as a hub. So here we don't have the cities, we just have it by country. Mm-hmm. And we see also that Fiji...
That's Nandi.
...is also an important hub for the flight connectivity. So when we now look at the connections that we were able to trace from the shipping data, so we see here these are the shipping connections between Asian countries and also Australia, and here we have the Pacific countries. So there's a lot of shipping going on, different types of ship, container, bulk, cargo. So these are the connections through ships, and this is actually the trade node diagram. So we see that all these Pacific countries, they source their products from almost all countries that we have here in terms of shipping connection. But we can see that a lot of countries, they don't have a direct link, but they trade through hubs. When we look at the flight connection, then this node diagram is even more sparsely populated. When we now look at the tourist flows, we see also, there is this node diagram is much more dense. So all these tourists, they come to the Pacific through certain hubs. The question now is how can we organize this in a more efficient way? Because certainly it's not good that every Pacific country has a direct link. As a trade economist, I was still puzzled to know whether the gravity model fits this data set. And I think since not so many people here in the room are trade economists, I will just skip these slides. The paper is published as a working paper, so you can also look up the results. What we find when we run this analytical exercise is, of course, we can measure the disadvantage that the Pacific countries face when they engage in international trade or when they try to attract international tourists, so we can basically estimate the trade costs. Having a direct link obviously helps to get tourists in and also to have more trade. However, as I said, not every country should have a direct link. It's not an efficient way. We now try to extend this work. We try to get more time series data because this is just a cross section. We also try to look at the possible, whether we can assess the impact of different policies on the connectivity. So this is ongoing work with ADB in Manila. So now we change completely topics and look at the exchange rates. Our dean, Naoki Yoshino, is an expert on exchange rates, and he motivated me to write this paper. When we look at the exchange rate choices in the Pacific, we see that most of them have adopted an external currency. We have four countries that have decided to have a currency basket. So this is Fiji, Samoa, Solomon Islands, and Tonga. What they do normally when they have a currency basket, they use a trade-weighted basket. So depending on where the most trade goes, then the currency has a higher weight in the basket. I'm not sure how many people are here are familiar with these baskets. But the question is, you know, whether these regimes that are in place are really optimal for the Pacific. Of course, they are small economies, and sometimes they are too small to have a complicated exchange rate regime in place. But we argue that there could be some room of improvement in terms of the weights in the basket. And also some people, some countries could maybe switch from an external currency to a basket. Because when you have an external currency in place, then of course you lose the independence of monetary policy. You also lose the seniorage. But it could be an advantage to lure in tourists. When you have a free float, then you probably have a lot of volatility in your exchange rate. I'm doing time-wise, okay, just a couple of more minutes. When we look at here at the fluctuation of the exchange rate, we have the dotted line is Australian dollar, USD. We see that there's a lot of fluctuation between the Australian dollar and the US dollar. When we look at the Pacific countries that had a basket currency in place, there's not too much fluctuation. So they're basically able to stabilize their exchange rates, which in some sense is a good thing. But when we look at the GDP volatility, so we have here the dotted lines are the countries in the Pacific that have an external currency, and the solid line are the one with the basket. You basically see that the ones with the basket, they fluctuate more than the ones that have an external currency. And normally, if you use these basket currencies in a, in a good way, you should have less volatility in terms of GDP.
Is that the coefficient of variation, the brackets? Or
the percentages?
Yeah. The coefficient of variation, yeah. So in this paper that is an ADBI working paper, we construct a simple model how to better manage the basket weight. So the weights in the basket should not only depend on trade, but also on tourism, on the interest rates, on government expenditures. And then we can basically simulate. So basically, the government tries to minimize this function. And so depending whether they want to minimize the fluctuations of exchange rate or whether they want to minimize the fluctuations of GDP, we can then calculate the optimal weights of the currencies in the basket. So this is the case of Samoa, where depending on the preference of the government, we have different weights between the US dollar and the American dollar in the basket. Okay, this brings me to the conclusion. So this paper finds that the Fiji Islands and Tonga would do better if they peg their currency more towards the US dollar. The Solomon should direct their baskets more towards the Australian dollar. And Samoa we find that it depends on what are the policy preferences. So overall, as I said, we found that they put too much emphasis on stabilizing the exchange rate, and they don't use their basket well in order to stabilize their fluctuations in GDP. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Right, thank you very much.
Sorry we didn't leave.
That's all right. We've got 16.
We can stay over.
We can stay 5 minutes over, maybe. Yeah. And thank you, Matthias, for presenting two papers in about 13 minutes. It's quite impressive. So do we have any questions? I guess one of the things that I was going to ask you, Christopher, is in the book you talk about not just increasing linkages between the Pacific and Asia, but also policy lessons that Asia
Correct.
Provides to the Pacific. So perhaps you'd like to talk about some of those. It's something you didn't touch on very much in your presentation, and it's in the book.
So I'm just trying to think. I mean, so the easy one is sort of how ASEAN has struggled over a 50-year period to further its integration. So, I mean, in many ways, there are tangible ways they face similar things with strongly disproportionately sized. We have large and small members. There was histories of political conflict and how ASEAN overcame those sorts of things. So, I mean, that comes to mind. I mean, I mentioned the financing for small and medium enterprises, the way the Pacific has come up with some innovations for that that might be applicable to the Pacific. So, I mean, not the strong.
John. First of all, and
can I ask two questions? Firstly, you made the point that the Pacific really needs to be thinking about Asia as being the increasingly dominant trade and investment partner. Mm-hmm. Yet when you look at the activities of the Pacific's trade ministries, nearly all their time spent negotiating trade agreements with Australia or the EU, how constructive is it for them to think about stopping worrying about BPAs and PACER Plus and just concentrate on where the action is?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think there's an awful lot of wasted effort. My other question, which is also about wasted effort, is in the discussion of optimal currency arrangements, what you haven't looked at is the opportunity cost of all the resources involved in reserve banks. I often think that some of the smartest people in a country end up in the Reserve Bank, and they're far more useful things they could do
if they were in the Ministry of Finance
managing a currency. So I'm wondering if your analysis has also looked at the opportunity costs associated with having an independent exchange rate regime.
Excellent. Two excellent questions, and we might take Jonathan's as well.
Okay. Yes, mine's a pretty quick question, Christopher. I was able to read the book over the weekend, and I think that one of the things that struck me the most whilst reading through was the amounts of data you've managed to pull together from such a great range of sources. I was wondering if you had any intentions of actually making that data publicly available in an easily accessible format, like you do with the Pacific Economic Monitor.
Okay.
Okay.
Why don't we, Bob's first, and why don't we let Matthias take the lead in responding to Bob's point.
I mean, that's a very good point. If a country has 20,000 inhabitants, they probably shouldn't have a central bank with, I don't know, 500 employees. But for example, we've just been to Suva and talked to the governor. They have a central bank in place and also a basket currency, and we think that they could optimize their basket currency. So, but your point is very valid. Yeah, there not every country should have a central bank, but we didn't look at the because it's hard to, I guess, estimate the cost to run a central bank. So this. About the data, I mean the data.
I can answer that one. Okay. But let me remember Bob's point. So you had about the exchange. I mean, usually the IMF Article 4 is when they go into the Pacific countries. We think they're better served probably using overseas currencies for now. Most of them, it's really just maybe PNG. But you can see what the PNG, you know, what the Reserve Bank of PNG has been doing lately, and that's another problem I think with applying the normal rules. I mean, this is what we learn when we work in economics in the Pacific is, you know, kind of throw out your traditional rules. And, you know, there's all these other exchange barriers that don't, you know, may matter more than you know, with your exchange rate regime. So in general, yeah, probably the Pacific Department doesn't view this as being a particular priority, but at the same time, it's an interesting intellectual exercise that does apply to some of the larger countries. Your other question was, can you quickly remind me? It was a really good point.
The government's trade ministry is focusing on
Yeah.
trade agreements with Australia and Europe.
I mean, I think you're right. At the same time, I think the channels for that sort of negotiation may be very different across the development partners. So the way the Chinese do it, it may be much more back channel, less upfront. That said, as someone who's done a lot of trade economics, I generally find that countries emphasize preferential trading areas and these way too much. I mean, it focus on the fundamentals, which is, you know, what's your relative productivity in general. I think this is like a little micro industry that creates lots of nice jobs for economists. But in the end, you know, I mean, that you know, the usual dictum is, you know, for these small countries, you're probably better off unilaterally liberalizing because that's going to be where the real benefits come from anyway. So, yeah, so not a clear answer in terms of is PACER Plus a waste of time or not. I don't know. But my instinct is, yeah, with the Asian negotiations, it may happen through different channels. And the problem is the Pacific just doesn't figure in the scheme of things for plans. So one of the projects I'm working on is Timor-Leste's desperate desire to become a member of ASEAN. This asymmetry, it just doesn't matter to ASEAN. They don't want to. And that's often the case for the Pacific, is they're just too small. And in the scheme of global capital, it doesn't matter. So finding the niches where, you know, there's something the Pacific's offering that's unique, and then people will pay attention. So now China's interested in the Pacific because all of a sudden they find, actually, it's a nice place to send our tourists, you know, our visitors. We like to go there. So, you know, those kind of opportunities. Or we're looking, you know, for a place to farm sea cucumber or giant clam. All of a sudden, yeah, then you'll get the Chinese entrepreneurs going into the Pacific to do those activities. And they'll definitely come to the Pacific to get the fish. So it's that sort of opportunity. And then, Jonathan, yeah, so the intention will be, right now we're still vetting, and this has been this is actually the final stop in a multi-country tour where we're sort of disseminating the book, and because of people like yourself pointing out errors, we're trying to clean the data a little more. You're right, it was an arduous data compilation effort. At the same time, it's so messy, and every time I read the book, I find a new error or something that, you know, data that was reported by some national government, which is not credible at all. And our responsibility is really to vet that and just, instead of reporting that figure, put an asterisk there because there's no way this country had that level of trades, for example. I mean, and it predominates efforts to use secondary data sources to analyze the Pacific. It's just really bad. And you get all sorts of errors. You get currency imports being reported as imports of paper. You get ship registries reported as imports of ships, and it really skews the data. So that's why, you know, part of the enterprise of the ADB and all the development partners really has to be to redouble efforts to improve the quality of statistics and think about some new ways to do that more cost effectively.
But you will get that.
We will get over it once we. Please send, if anyone spots any, you know, if anyone can spot any errors, please let me, because I mean, it's not useful if we don't vet it a little. So this was just a very small initial printing, an initial release, but hoping to fix up the data a little more before we release it publicly. Yeah. And thanks for calling attention to the Monitor. Actually, last week we launched the latest issue. It's available online. As usual, we have our country summaries, but we also have a nice set of papers looking at the fiscal and economic impact of natural disasters in the Pacific, both from a governance standpoint, as well as your fiscal and economic growth. So have really, and I was grateful to Matt and Tess Newton Kane, both DPC affiliates, for writing an excellent paper updating readers on the situation in Vanuatu from Cyclone Pam.
All right, any other questions? Yeah. Ashley?
I just wanted to touch on, you mentioned remittances and you showed that slide, and I was just curious what scope you see perhaps for growth in migration from the Pacific to Asia. It seems like those Asian markets are fairly well served by the abundance of labour within the region, you know, so many migrants from Indonesia working in Malaysia and Singapore and so on.
Don't forget Philippines.
Yeah, of course.
The giant in the room.
Yeah, absolutely. So do you see much scope for demand from workers from the Pacific, perhaps in the future? What type of do you see that as being a potential channel to increase remittances to the region, basically?
Sure. We might just take a... Is there another question? Okay.
Well, I'll take the question. I mean, I actually... This is where the advantage of being small. So even if it's only 100 workers from Kiribati going, that has a huge impact on Kiribati, has virtually no impact in Asia. So, I mean, that's where they can do that. So Kiribati is actively pursuing that, trying... This is the whole USP campus in Kiribati to train nurses to go work abroad. And I think the Pacific worker will bring something slightly different than the Asian worker will. So I do see that as opportunity. Not that it's going to be large numbers from the Asian standpoint, zero effect. But from the standpoint of the Pacific Islands, sure, that should happen, especially as you get the, you know, taking advantage of the diaspora and you're building migration networks. So we already see that in the North Pacific, the links with certain enterprises in the U.S. So you have this whole link between the chicken farms in Arkansas and the Marshallese. And once those networks get going, it actually becomes a really important to Marshall Islands, even though, you know, you wouldn't think they have a particular advantage. But once you get a foot in the door, that can happen. So I do see that. And, that's somewhat the challenge of the Pacific is, you know, the young people generally, once they get educated, it's often because the opportunities in country are so rare. You get a good government job or you migrate because they haven't developed very vibrant business sectors. The business environments aren't very favorable. But so I see it as an advantage, especially when you have older workers from the Pacific who lived abroad, but then they want to come home and retire. There's a real opportunity there.
Yeah. Can always finish early.
Yeah, we might. Matthias, I wanted to ask, are both of those papers available on the ADBI?
Yeah, they're both available as working papers, yeah.
Okay, fantastic.
I mean, and part of the reason we come to ANU, we really value ANU as being a maybe the premier international center. I might make a shout out to the East-West Center in Honolulu, where I was working before I joined ADB. But, the work you're doing here is really valuable in creating these networks. And so very happy if any of, especially graduate students, professors want to work there. We're very happy to work with you. So this is an initial study. Now we're planning more detailed work. Right now I have another project, which actually Matt is working on as well, trying to develop more in detail case study of what evokes change in these economic linkages. So why do, we know we can look at trade changes over time, but what were the effects that actually lead? How does Fiji Water develop? That's a famous case study. So trying to get at the more institutional developments, the policy changes that really evoke changes in this, because there's all these factors that will lead to the outcomes we observe, but trying to figure out how do you prompt change? How do you prompt development of a new linkage? So I hope to come back over the years to talk about this and would welcome sharing data or other resources if more people want to work on this. I think it is the main project that the Pacific has to work on over the next few decades, because the growth of Asia is just a reality, and the way the global economy adjusts to that is going to be very important in shaping how things go.
I wonder if I can ask the last question. Thank you. In terms of the key drivers for tourism expansion in these countries, I wonder to know what were the key drivers. Could it be purchasing power parity in these countries?
Mm-hmm.
If so, what's the government's response or policy response? And what impact do such a policy have on domestic economies in these countries?
Good question. One close to my heart. So, I mean, this is one where a lot more detailed research is needed.
Yes.
So we've done the broad survey. Definitely relative costs matter. I mean, it's a highly elastic market. We've seen an example that comes to mind where the purchasing power parity really matters is the competition between Vanuatu and Fiji. So where Vanuatu costs increase, we do see a diversion. So generally, those are direct competitors. And more generally, the Pacific is a high-cost tourism destination. It's very hard for Pacific destinations to achieve the economies of scale to compete with Bali, for example, for the beach tourists from Australia. Of course, it's developed somewhat of a niche with more family-oriented tourism, where the less unsavory elements of Bali is kind of a turnoff to families, perhaps. But obviously, distance, the airfares are a key constraint to tourism development. Of course, that's an endogenous factor. You know, there's no flights because no one wants to visit. No one wants to visit because there's no flights. But again, you're in an environment in which you have these massive rises in total international visitorship, and the Pacific actually has a declining market share in that context. So that just means where you see that, you know, there's tremendous opportunity, but distance, achieving the economies of scale, lowering costs, things like that, and on the lowering cost side, definitely the human resource side has been a constraint to development of a lot of destinations where they don't really, in the Pacific countries, you don't have the reserve wages of Pacific workers tend to be very high. So this is why some of the Palau essentially utilizes overseas guest workers to support their tourism industry. So, I mean, there's all these constraints to tourism development. And obviously, the performance of government matters so much for tourism industries in terms of do you have the basic public goods and do people feel safe going to these places, which is another challenge for the Pacific because governance isn't so strong. The government's ability to translate revenues into improvements in public services has been a challenge. And that's where certain countries seem to have turned the corner. Cook Islands and Palau have clearly turned the corner, and now it's just sort of managing it. Fiji is well along, you know, that where I showed that graph of the share of GDP with tourism. But all of the countries who have aspirations of gaining mass market tourism will need to really step up in terms of government delivery of basic services.
All right. Well, on that note, unless there's a final question, no? Well, please join me in thanking our speakers.
You have been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter for all the latest updates or connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.